Hey there, and welcome to Marvel by the Month. My name's Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
Rob, you were just mentioning off microphone that you had a virtual social event this evening.
I did, and it was a beer tasting, and I realized in the middle of the first can of beer that I was going to need help. I ran down and got Barb to start drinking the parts of the beers. Barb doesn't drink beer ever, so she was willing to chip in.
Nice.
But then, like, the third beer was a Belgian IPA, like a triple. It was or I don't even know if it was an IPA, whatever it was a Belgian ale, and it was 9.5%. So I have the fizzy warmness of beers from around the world going in my brain right now.
This is going to be great right up until the point where you fall asleep in the middle of the podcast.
It'll just be, I'll get really animated, really angry about no thing at all, and then I will just pass out. That'll be my jam.
Yeah. Terrific. Well, that's great.
How about you? Are you dead sober, I'm guessing?
Yeah. No, I'm on the highball again tonight to keep this train rolling. Child wrangling all day long, which, you know, is good. But also, I would say I'm excited for him to go back to school. But, you know, that's not how that works anymore. So anyway. We have some really good comics to talk about this evening. We're going to be covering all the Marvel comics. Well, we'll be covering some of the Marvel comics that hit the newsstands in August of 1966. We've got the first Silver Age appearance of a Golden Age Marvel hero. We're going to hit the jackpot with a long anticipated introduction of a major Spider-Man sporting character. And we're going to ride along with Sergeant Fury all the way to Berlin for a high stakes rescue operation. And to help us do all of that, we've invited one of our favorite guests back onto the program. He's the writer of Shudder, Glory, Ringside, Stellar, Marvel Knights Hulk, and Morbius the Living Vampire, Joe Keating. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month.
Always good to be back. I was starting to feel like it was just slightly too long, and then I got the call.
So this is either your fourth or fifth appearance, depending on how you want to count it. What folks haven't heard yet is that we had you and another friend join us for a special bonus episode that we have not released yet. You're always so generous with your time. I really appreciate you making time to chat with us.
Oh, man, are you joking? Like, I think we've covered this before, but when you guys first told me about the podcast at Rose City way back when, I was like, yeah, I'm in. Like, whenever you need somebody, let me know. And so as I believe I said before, like on air, like that's when I pitched you all that Atlas episode we did. Yeah, I'm always down to talk Marvel, especially this era.
Well, fantastic. I'm so glad you're not sick of us yet. I can't believe you're not, but
yeah. I'm so happy you weren't just being, you know, polite at Rose City because it's really, at this point you're past polite. You've been on four or five times again, depending on our time traveling, but,
yes.
Yeah. How am I doing in terms of guest stars, in terms of frequency?
You are
silver medalist, I think.
I think only Noah has been on more, and only one episode more, and he's not even a big famous guy, so you know,
he's just a guy we know who swears a lot. Yeah.
All right, so you need to have me on again. I want to up Noah. I want to
Right.
Steve
sounds
Martin
good
to the SNL of the show.
Yeah,
that's
we're gonna get you the smoking jacket.
Awesome. Well, I'm super excited to dig into this month's comics, but first we got some historical context to provide for what Marvel readers were seeing in the headlines when they went to the newsstands in August of 1966. There's actually a lot of stuff that went on in August of 66, so let's just get started. Rob, do you want to kick us off with our first news item?
On the 5th of August, ground was broken in Manhattan at the future site of the World Trade Center, which, as we know, didn't last all the way till now, but it was a really big deal. On the same day, Caesar's Palace Hotel and Casino opened in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
So that's a smaller but wider building.
Yes. Your architectural knowledge is stunning.
Thank you.
It's incredible. On the 30th of August, the United States Senate approved the confirmation of Constance Baker Motley of New York City as U.S. District Judge, making her the first African-American woman to ever be named to the federal bench.
Wow. And then also in August, people got born. On the 7th of August, Jimmy Wales, co-founder of Wikipedia, was born in Huntsville, Alabama. Thanks, Jimmy. That's how we figure out a lot of what we talk about right now.
I got that note from Wikipedia.
On the 14th of August, Halle Berry, who played Storm in X-Men and several sequels, was born in Cleveland, Ohio.
Halle Berry and Jimmy Wales are exactly the same age, which I don't think I would have put money on.
That is mind-boggling.
Let's see. We got some space race news. On the 14th of August, Lunar Orbiter 1 successfully entered its orbit around the moon, becoming the first U.S. spacecraft to orbit a heavenly body other than the Earth. So that's one for the America. on the 17th, 3 days later, the Pioneer 7 space probe was launched by the United States and placed to an orbit around the sun. In 1986, it would wind up being the first Earth probe to gather data about Halley's Comet. And we would have contact with the Pioneer 7 probe for 29 years until March of 1995. So that one was built to last. So that's two for America.
Yeah, that's like 2 to 10 for the, you know, we really haven't beat the Soviets very often.
We're limiting it to August. we're going to narrow the scope and give ourselves a win here. And then on the 24th of August, the Soviet Union launched the Luna 11 space probe, which was going to send its own photographs of the moon taken from lunar orbit. But after the probe arrived, debris lodged in one of the attitude control engines. The camera could not be aimed at the lunar surface. Instead, the probe transmitted images of the blackness of outer space. So nice try, Soviets.
Still not good from the free throw line. Yeah. Okay. So Beatles by the month on the 2nd, John Lennon's claim that the Beatles were, quote, bigger than Jesus, 5 months earlier, resulted in a boycott of bookstores and record stores that sold the Beatles' music. Tommy Charles, station manager at WAQY AM radio in Birmingham, Alabama, called for the boycott after Lennon's words were reprinted in the July issue of American teen magazine Datebook. The boycott spread internationally before Lennon apologized when the group arrived in Chicago on August 11th. So, you know, they had a week and a half before he apologized, which I'm sure made, you know, Brian Epstein very upset at the time.
Well, and it also seems like they may have dodged the bullet up until it was reprinted in the magazine.
Yeah. And it was reprinted in shorter quotes. So it was even more out of context than his broader talk about Christianity in general and religion and rock and roll and how long those things last historically. So, you know, on the 5th of August, the Beatles album Revolver, which is awesome, was released in the United Kingdom and will be released in the United States 3 days later, minus three songs that had appeared on the US version of Yesterday and Today, which was a Yesterday and Today is a shorter American release. On the 29th of August, the Beatles played their penultimate concert in front of a crowd of 25,000 people at Candlestick Park in San Francisco. Subsequently, the group played only in the studio, with the exception of their unscheduled rooftop concert on the building housing Apple Records on January 30th, 1969, where they did that very awesome version of Don't Let Me Down, which touches my heart to this day.
So they were really like only a touring band for about 3 years, like once they
were the Beatles.
Yeah. Once they were the Beatles.
Before that, they were just nonstop touring band, cover band, you know, doing it every day, 7 days a week.
Man. August of 1966 was also a big month for Texas murderers. On the 1st of August, former U.S. Marine sniper Charles Whitman opened fire from the observation deck of the tower overlooking the University of Texas at Austin, where he was enrolled as a student. Over the course of 96 minutes, Whitman shot 43 people, 13 of them fatally, before being shot and killed by Austin police. So yeah, you can bet that was definitely a headline in papers. And then something that would come to light later was on the 6th of August. Kenneth McDuff kidnapped and shot three teenagers in Everman, Texas, beginning a string of at least 9 murders as a serial killer that continued after a lengthy prison sentence from which he was paroled in 1989. Then he resumed killing people. He was arrested again in 1992 and would be executed by lethal injection in 1998. So, yeah, not sure what's going on in Texas in August, but... Yeah, it's the heat. It's got to be the heat, right?
And I guess reform didn't work out too well in Texas in that time.
Yeah. And as always, you know, I mention these things just not only to provide a little historical context, but also hopefully to, you know, bump up our listener numbers with a little bit of true crime.
So, true crime. Yeah. Hey, everybody, true crime. Tens of thousands of listeners. Vietnam news. On the 7th. Of August, 7 American warplanes were shot down in a single day over the skies of North Vietnam, the highest U.S. air loss since the war had begun. 5 of the planes were F-105 Thunder Chief fighter bombers. Within the space of a month, 25 F-105s would be shot down, mostly by anti-aircraft guns. On the 16th of August, the House Un-American Activities Committee began an investigation of Americans who had demonstrated against the Vietnam War, seeking, quote, evidence that communist organizations were instigating their operations.
Yeah. I didn't think the House Un-American Activities Committee survived the 50s and McCarthyism. So I was kind of surprised to find out that it was still a thing.
I wouldn't be surprised if they're getting really riled up about Portland, Oregon right now.
Yes. We are now the poster child for un-American activities in America, mm-hmm. Conducted by Americans.
Like asking for democracy and freedoms. Whatever. Well, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I'm not going to get into it.
Oh, okay. So I grabbed a bunch of, this was also a big month for the Cultural Revolution in China. I grabbed a bunch of stuff from this because I realized I didn't really know much about the Cultural Revolution. Like, I had like a vague awareness of it. You guys, it was pretty gnarly. Like, there's some,
do go on.
Yeah. Well, here, let me give you a sample. On the 8th of August, 1966, Chairman Mao Zedong's 16 articles was approved by the Central Committee of China's Communist Party and published nationwide the next day in the People's Daily. It called on citizens to, quote, change the mental outlook of the whole of society and to, quote, struggle against and crush those persons in authority who are taking the capitalist road. So we've seen some of that before with, you know, kind of these ludicrously over the top quotes. But then it starts getting a little scarier. So then on the 13th of August, at the close of a week-long session of the Communist Party Central Committee, Mao announced the beginning of a purge of party officials as a part of the Cultural Revolution. So that's not a great word, purge. And then 5 days later, on the 18th, a crowd of nearly 1 million Chinese college and high school students rallied at Tiananmen Square. Chairman Mao appeared in person, dressed in the simple Red Army soldier's uniform that would soon be adopted by his followers. He told the group, "Rebel. Without rebellion, nothing bad can be fixed." And here's what they did with that. 4 days later, on the 22nd of August, on the third day of demonstrations in Beijing, China's Red Guards, which were mostly teenagers, began putting up posters with an ultimatum advising people to give up bourgeois fashions and habits, including Western styles of clothing, which they referred to as Hong Kong-style clothes, hairstyles and habits such as using a taxicab, getting a manicure or a massage, or ordering an expensive meal in a restaurant. Neon signs were torn down by the guards, and storekeepers were warned to remove foreign goods from sale. The ultimatum advised that people would have 1 week to purge themselves of alien influence and added that, quote, if you neglect this, we will not be friendly and we will take action.
Damn.
End quote. So the Cultural Revolution was mostly carried out, like most of these actions were carried out by like college students, high school students, and even like primary and middle school students. Like, that's the age that we're talking about. Just kids going wild. On the 25th of August, the Red Guards began the transformation of Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, formerly a Buddhist kingdom and now a Chinese autonomous region. Ancient relics were shipped away from the monasteries or destroyed, and shrines were vandalized. And then on the very last day of August, the Daxing Massacre, which is 3 days of murder in the Daxing district of Beijing, peaked with the deaths of several hundred people in a single day. With the sanction of the government, the Red Guards killed 324 people, including elderly and infants, before a garrison of Beijing police finally intervened to halt the killings. Things got real in China in a hurry. And I think it's kind of important to keep that in mind, because, like, obviously going forward, we're going to see, like, as we have seen, like, Russian, Soviet generic baddies in the book. I think it's important just to have a sense of context. Like, as we start seeing Chinese villains showing up, it's like, this is the reason we were seeing these, because these are the headlines that were coming out of China right now.
Yeah, so. This is a really crazy month. If you overlap the popular culture stuff with mass murders in Texas and the space race and Vietnam and this and what's happening in China, it's I'm guessing, you know, Stan, this is going to affect whatever Stan writes in the next, you know, month or two out. That's usually how it goes.
Yeah.
Could you imagine an August where everything seems insane every other day? It's almost, what a far off world this is.
What a crazy science fiction scenario. Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. It's wow. I don't know what it is about Augusts, but there you go. The world's on fire then and now. So some things never change. So that's what was going on in August 66. We're going to take our first break. And then when we come back, we're going to start talking about some of the funny books that came out this month. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back here on Marvel by the Month. All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. So at this point in Marvel's publishing history, they're putting out about 10 superhero and superhero adjacent books every month. Then they're doing some Westerns. They're doing some fashion comics as well. We don't have time to cover more than two or three issues an episode in detail, but they're all a part of the same continuity. So we don't want to drop any major story threads or leave you hanging from previous episodes. So we're going to kind of briefly touch on a few things that were going on this month that we won't be covering in depth on this episode, but might wind up covering in depth on future episodes. Stan's trying this incredibly ambitious interconnected storyline that's going through all the split story books. So Tales to Astonish, Tales of Suspense, and Strange Tales about the Secret Empire and AIM and them. And we're just going to do a whole episode on that at some point, because it's wild. It goes on for like 8 months. And yeah, across like 25 different issues. So yeah, Rob has seen the outline that I put together earlier today.
And luckily I've read, you know, 90% of them already. But
Well, I'd like to get that list from you. That'd be totally cool to read, because I haven't.
Yeah. At first I was just kind of dismissing them. And then I was like, oh, wait, these all add up to something.
I'm guessing Douglas has like a, you know, little package of those already ready for everyone, you know.
Right.
At Books with Pictures.
Right. cool. So, Rob, what were the Avengers up to? We left them on a cliffhanger last month.
Yeah, they were essentially fighting the Cobra-themed Klansmen known as the Serpent Society, who also beat up 33% of Marvel's black characters, which was Bill Foster. He was a scientist helping Henry Pym try to not be 10 feet tall. The issue ended with a cliffhanger where it seemed like Goliath was considering whether or not the Serpents had a point. So he was like, oh no, you know, maybe this white supremacy thing is totally okay. And but of course it was a bluff. The Avengers lured them into a public fight to expose them, and they took down the snakes with an assist from a newly heroic Black Widow. So this is where she really turns towards being an Avenger or a heroic character.
Yes. And then over in the pages of Thor, Thor fights a planet. He fights Ego, the living planet. Last month, we got our first glimpse of Ego on the final page of the main story. And he's the master of the Black Galaxy, which is threatening the entire universe. Because we find out this month that Ego plans to seed the universe with his antibodies and conquer it. So Thor fights his way through, like literally through, the living planet that is Ego. And then he detonates a universe-shaking thermoblast inside of it. And then Thor and his trusty sidekick, the Recorder, escape the Black Galaxy. And Ego vows to seal the Black Galaxy off from the known universe so that never happens again. But this thing was just... I mean this with all respect and love and sincerity, but this is just wall-to-wall just Kirby nonsense. Like, this is so good.
It's
like,
nonsense.
It's the best.
Yeah. I don't mean nonsense in a pejorative way. I mean, it is just like, it is
brilliant is the term. Yeah. I loved it.
It is.
I know it's not one we're supposed to be deep diving on, but I thought it was awesome. I have some of the issues that orbit this one. Like, I actually have the next issue, the People Breeders one, and I'll have a few of them. And I just think this run gets just, I mean, the run of Thor, really from actually like 124 to like, I don't even know when, it just gets awesome. And it's cool because there are certain things, like, technically I think I see Kirby doing more of that he expands in later in the 70s, like the first page, splash page, then second, third page, double page spread, sort of, you know.
The double splash.
I thought that was really cool. Because, again, you see him do it more and more as time goes on. And perfecting it as time goes on. And then, I don't know, like, my favorite Kirby remains the 70s Kirby, because it's just, like, an idea. Like, it's so many ideas that, A, people have been mining them for last whatever amount of years. And I feel like this almost felt like a prototypical version of a 70s Kirby comic, which is one of the highest compliments I could pay, because I just think of stuff as just awesome. It felt like... Yeah, prototypical, actually like Eternals almost, I guess, or even New Gods. But yeah, man, I thought it was, I mean, dude fights a planet. Like,
oh, that, yeah. No, it's like the thing I think that I love most about this, and I totally agree with you that this is like, we are toward the beginning of a really good stretch of Thor. It's basically like, as soon as Don Blake stops becoming a factor in the story, and it, you know, Kirby is just kind of encouraged to go bigger and more Cosmic Kirby is the best Kirby.
Yeah, I feel like when Hercules shows up, that's when it just gets insane.
Yeah,
yes,
like that's once Hercules just shows up.
Yeah,
I want it. That's 124, isn't it? Somewhere around there.
I think so. We just covered it a few months ago. So yeah.
Yeah,
I loved this month. It was like all of the things that I love of Ditko on Doctor Strange, just things you can't imagine being drawn. Mm.
Yeah,
that is like page after page after page in this specific book. It was awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on, man.
I love looking through it and not reading the words and just like trying to figure out what Jack is what the story he's trying to tell. And I love the idea that he hands these off to Stan and Stan's like, all right. It's like, come on, Stan. I thought you were the writer.
Stan wrote, he fights a planet, you know, and then handed it over to him. And Kirby went, okay, I got this.
Yeah, at this point, I don't even think it's that, dude. I think Kirby just turned in Kirby. A bunch of art with things written in the pan and the panel borders.
Yeah.
I think we've talked about this on the podcast before. I used to be really hard on Stan and thinking, you know, whatever. I used to be, I don't know if I go as far as say anti-Stan, but pretty hard against him. I will say over the years, I've softened a lot on him for many reasons, a number of which is like, as much as I love 70s Kirby, like I miss Stan's scripting. Yes. I do feel like he is able to ground it a bit more than I previously had given credit to. Also, I just think he was a brilliant editor and a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant like marketing guy. Unfortunately, to the detriment of some of the artists, but I don't know. Like, there's this one splash page in here I thought was really cool with Thor's fighting the antibodies.
Yes,
that pile of antibodies, like a tower.
Yeah, and I forget exactly what the panel said, but he really did. He did that thing in like pro wrestling, like he put over the splash page. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Like. Not even, like, I mean, frankly, the splash page on itself kind of goes over itself, but I don't know. Like, I think he was a good hype man. That's almost a better way to look at it from pro wrestling terms.
Yeah.
He was the really great hype man for that. I think his era is great. And I think they're both bringing it.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. There's so much. I seriously, it took my breath away page after page in this issue. Mm-hmm. And I'm not that you know, usually Thor is just sort of doing Thor things, and especially the Don Blake times we've been through together, it have been a little rough sometimes, but this was just awesome. This was like, you know, we started looking forward to the Tales of Asgard in the back of the book because Kirby was sort of set free, and now it's just Kirby set free through the whole book.
I'm so glad you mentioned the Tales of Asgard. I love the one in here. I mean, essentially, Hurricane, it's just like it's a barbarian funeral, you know, and that's it. Yep. And I found it very moving, actually. I was really blown away by it. And there's this one part in specific where Helia, or how do I pronounce her name? Helia, and her Valkyries come to like take the barbarian body, and then he rides off into eternity towards Valhalla. And I was like, oh, this guts you. It was so good. Yeah, Tales of Asgard, there's a, and actually I have it on the spinner rack. There's a compilation that Marvel did at this time, like, or not too long after, but just a bunch of Tales of Asgard stories. And I highly recommend it. I'm sure you can get it for like $10, especially if you get like a reader copy of that. And it's just like short after short are so good. And I rarely hear them talk about, but I love the idea of Tales of Asgard. And like, I've always kind of wanted to do a comic where we do that in the back, where it's like expands on the universe in such a way. And like, again, like in this one in particular, it's really, it's just them mourning the loss of this warrior, you know?
Who's not even a believer necessarily in,
in
their mythology or their, you know, pantheon. But he's a warrior. So he is welcome to Valhalla, and it is moving.
Rob, do you want to give us the lowdown on what the Fantastic Four got up to this month?
Claw returns. So when we last saw Claw, he just had his ass handed to him by the Black Panther in FF number 53. At the end of that issue, he jumped into his sound transformer in a last ditch effort to give himself powers. So the sound transformer was making like shiny red King Kong monsters and things like that. And in Fantastic Four number 56, we find out that it worked. He's now a creature composed of pure sound. And he attacks Reed, Sue, and Ben in the Baxter building. It looks like he's going to succeed in taking them down until Reed gets a special drone delivery from Wakanda. Early, you know, prototype drones. Black Panther sent him a pair of vibranium knuckles, and he uses them to give Claw a beat down. It's sort of like the precursor to Frank Miller's, you know, kryptonite gloves for Batman fighting Superman. It's pretty awesome because they're just constantly like, how do we beat this guy? He's just made of sound. Like, what do we do? And turns out Black Panther had them covered.
And I love that Reed's the one who gets to use them. Like, we never see Reed, you know, really do anything. You know, he solves problems with his head, not with his fists. Yeah. But this was like, no, you came to my home. And he just like puts the knuckles on and just takes him to school. It's pretty great. And now Claw is his more familiar, like solid sound form. I just remember being introduced to him in Secret Wars, and I'm like, what the hell is this?
That me too. I think I had no knowledge of Claw before he was like a red guy with a sonic arm and made of sound.
Iron Man and Captain America in Tales of Suspense, they had a couple of pretty compelling adventures. So Iron Man finished off a 3-issue fight with a new and improved Titanium Man by beating the rivets out of him for America.
America!
At the same time, Captain America had been incapacitated and impersonated by a new foe, the Adaptoid, who then immediately loses a fight against Marvel's latest C-list villain, the Tumbler. So Adaptoid, great villain. Tumbler, I don't even know if he ever shows up again. There you go.
Then the Avengers offer membership to Spidey.
Yes.
The Avengers plus Iron Man and Thor decide to offer membership to Spider-Man.
Yeah, and this is in Spider-Man Annual, right? Number 4?
Yeah. I thought it was awesome. I mean, there's just little things I really liked a lot about it. I mean, it in general, I felt like it's been interesting to come on here every once in a while and then like see where we're at, you know, the Marvel universe. And I felt like with this issue, I mean, and actually the regular Spider-Man book, I mean, really all of them, I felt like they finally really got, not finally, but I feel like they really got a handle on the idea of a Marvel universe, you know?
Yeah.
And kind of like through how casually things happen, I think we'll get into more in the Spider-Man issue, but I don't know, the little things I really liked in this one. I really liked how Goliath blocks the Hulk logo, and just knowing Artie, not knowing him personally, but knowing Artie Simek's work, I feel like they had to be intentional. And again, putting someone over, I felt like really put over Goliath's like height to block the Hulk logo in specific. I like the bureaucracy of the Avengers. I thought was kept, you know, in this era where, you know, you tell so much story in 20 pages, they spent like 3 to 4 pages on the bureaucracy of the Avengers, which I thought was cool. That was cool to see how it all worked. I thought there was some sweet foreshortening on Thor on page 4. My favorite page, though, was page 14, where Spider-Man just goes to the Daily Bugle just to mess with Jonah.
I know.
So he's good.
He just, yeah. he just flat out a
jerk. I thought that was beautiful. One thing I love so much about this, which is I feel like Spider-Man at his best, is when he sticks to his principles no matter how unpopular they are. I feel like that, you know, the Parker luck is always really focused on, but my favorite aspect of Spider-Man is like the strength of principle. Even when it could put you, you know, to your advantage to go against them or, you know, to perform against them. I felt with this, it was a really cool example of him sticking to his principles and not wanting to hand over the Hulk to the Avengers. So, and I thought that was a really cool moment.
I think what you said about Spidey sticking to his principles and being so fundamental to the character is really important. Like, I mean, this is a guy who, one time he didn't stick to his principles and his uncle got killed. And so like, right. From now on, it's like, no compromising anymore. It's like, I'm going to do the right thing no matter what, even if it kills me. And in some universes it does.
Right. And that lack of, I mean, in a weird way, that lack of compromise fits in well with Ditko's original objectivist sort of ideal of the character. Although Spider-Man's never, you know, he has so many obstacles to winning by, you know, sticking to his ideals, but that's also, regardless of that, the, you know, stick to your ideals. That's quintessential Peter Parker.
Oh, and also in this story, one thing that I think kind of gets forgotten about is that Spider-Man's one of the only people now who knows who the Hulk is because he sees the Hulk turn back in the banner. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he seems a little freaked out by it, but Spidey's, you know, just like, not only am I not going to tell anyone, I'm not going to turn you over to the Avengers either because I don't necessarily trust them to do right by you. So, you know, I think the list of people who know that the Hulk is Banner for sure. I think it's just Rick Jones, Spider-Man, and Lyndon Baines Johnson in the Marvel universe right now.
That's so weird.
I think that's it.
I forgot that LBJ was on the list. Yeah.
Yeah. So pretty cool. Good month of comics. So that's our quick hits. Let's take another break. And then when we come back, let's talk about the return of the original Human Torch here on Marvel by the Month.
Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Let's get into the Fantastic Four annual number 4. That's 4 annuals that we have gotten through Fantastic Four on this program.
I think Joe has been with us for at least one of them, maybe 2 of them. You were definitely here for the one that had the origin of Doom.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And then what was the other one? The first one was Namor's Invasion of Manhattan. Oh, the third one was the wedding.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That was, that was Noah, I think, who Joe needs to nemesis. Beat yeah. for the smoking jacket. Yeah. so we're 4 annuals into this, comic now. So this was written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby with Joe Sinnott. the main story is called The Torch That Was. And then there's also reprints of FF number 25 and number 26. We're just sort of zooming in on The Torch That Was. So one of the reasons we wanted Joe here is the episode we previously did with him was about the 1940s and 50s Marvel's heroes. So we covered some of Jim Hammond, the original Human Torch from the 50s. They just sort of quietly put the torch out to pasture. There was no narrative wrap up, nothing. He just sort of disappeared like Kaiser Soze.
I went back and looked at the last issue of Human Torch comics that was published in like 54 or whatever. It literally has a teaser for it. It's like, yeah, next month, more thrilling adventures of the Human Torch. It's like, not so much.
Nope. No, yeah.
That's just a big, cliffhanger forever.
Well, and yeah, it really is forever because it's not continued here. Because there's a few things. One is, beyond Namor's appearance, much earlier on, this says that the Human Torch last appeared 20 years ago. So that's the 40s. So yeah. Stan really goes out of his way to make sure you know that the 1950 stuff didn't happen. Which goes to my whole thesis that Fantastic Four number one is not the start of Marvel Universe, it's the first reboot. And I think it establishes the nature of Marvel Comics. Because, listeners at episode note, I love those 50s Atlas comics. I think they're really cool and they're really overlooked. And, I never heard Stan definitively say why he didn't. He said he forgot about them, which I don't believe. I assume it's just because they didn't work out, But I think that's a cool take, Marvel, as we know it, first appeared in 1938 with Marvel Science Stories, which is like a pulp thing. You know what's crazy about that? Here's a little factoid that I've been reluctant to put out there because I'm trying to buy myself a copy of this and don't want it to go crazy on eBay. The story in Marvel Science Stories number one is The Avengers of Outer Space.
Oh, really?
So the very first, like, and it's blurbed on the cover, The Avengers of Outer Space. So the very first publication that had anything Marvel related ever, and again, it's a prose pulp series with course illustrations, advertises the Avengers like 40, no, more than almost 30 years before the Avengers actually existed. So it's pretty rad.
Yeah, I would love to see that. Just somebody pick up that universe. It's like the new universe, but the old
shouldn't
universe.
Be saying this in public.
we'll just cut this. we're just going to cut all of this now. Too bad.
Yeah, I'm not 100% on what Marvel's current continuity or was, but Roy Thomas basically kind of retroactively. Kind of he added like the Invaders and things like that, he kind of like chopped and screwed the 50s stuff and sort of like shoehorned it in, but it's
I was
not.
Just really reading some of those issues, and it's like, so it was a crazy guy who was a college professor who was really into Cap, and so he had himself surgically altered to look like Cap. Like, I love Roy Thomas, the guy done a lot of great comics, but some of like. And it's not exclusive to him. It's, there's a lot of guys. I mean, even guys like John Byrne, where it's like they try to tweak the past so much to get it right. Where my take, whenever I've written this stuff, has been like, who cares? Just do something cool, you know? Yeah. Anyway, the point is they went out of their way to make sure you knew that. Yeah, the Human Torch had not existed since the 40s, according to.
Yeah, like just overlooking, erase the blip in the 50s when that the attempt at a restart. So a little bit more about the story. Johnny and Wyatt Wingfoot, they were still trying to figure out how to rescue the Inhumans from the Great Refuge when they ran into Lockjaw, who teleported them out. This is just a great just story tool. They're like, they ran into Lockjaw, so now they're back here for the annual. They're trying to befriend him, and they get transported. Meanwhile, the Mad Thinker has retrieved and revived the inert android form of the original Human Torch, who is suffering from amnesia. The Mad Thinker has a living computer named Quasimodo, who really wants a human form. And the Thinker sends the original torch after Johnny And the two of them battle to a stalemate until the rest of the FF and Wyatt and Lockjaw teleport in. Lockjaw transports them all to the Mad Thinker's lair. The Thinker destroys the original Torch, who makes a heroic turn at the end of the story. The Thinker escapes, and the original Torch's inert form is left to hang out with Quasimodo as it slowly powers down as well. So that's the basic summary, but you know, yeah. Let's get into this a little bit more. I was about to say unpack, but people say that at work and it makes me want to jump off of a building.
Yeah. Well, so one of the things I wanted to mention, we were talking about this during the break, is that there's a reason for the timing of this story and when it came out. And it has to do with an expiring copyright, as a lot of decisions are made in comics publishing. It's all about retaining control of that IP. I'm sure at both Marvel and DC, there are people whose job it is just to basically update databases of all the thousands of characters that, you know, are their assets, and where they were last used, so that they can make sure that, you know, hey, like no one's used Asbestos Man, you know, since 1964. It's like, well, quick, get Asbestos Man into a comic book so we don't lose the rights to that sweet, sweet character. And that's basically, that's one of the reasons why this story, I think, happened at the time. At least that's the version of the story that appears in Marvel, The Untold Story by Sean Howe, which we've recommended a few times on this podcast. And it's really, it's an excellent look into, you know, behind the scenes of Marvel Comics. But here's an excerpt from that. Carl Burgos, the creator of the original Human Torch, was pursuing legal action against Marvel Comics over the Human Torch copyright. Then one day in the summer of 1966, which is where we are right now, his daughter Susan watched as he destroyed every trace of his Marvel Comics career, which had to that point been hidden away from her. So he took all his comics out and just destroyed them. She said, "I never saw his collection until the day he threw it all out. I just happened to be in the backyard this summer day, and there was a whole pile of stuff in the yard. I took as many of the comics as I could carry back to my room like they were some treasure. He came in and demanded that I give him my comics. I got the impression that he either lost the case or something else had happened pertaining to it." Again, Burgos withheld details from his daughter, but over the years she learned the source of his ire. She said, "I grew up believing that he came up with this fabulous idea and that Stan Lee took it from him." In fact, Burgos's claims may never have made it to court. It may have been a reaction to a new Marvel comic book, because in early August, Lee and Kirby's Fantastic Four Annual Number 4 featured Burgos's original Human Torch battling the new Teenage Human Torch and the rest of the Fantastic Four. Cover dated October 1966, which is August 1966 in our time. It appeared exactly 28 years after Marvel Comics number 1. In other words, exactly as the initial 28-year copyright was expiring, the original Torch had been revived just long enough to ensure their copyright claim, only to be killed again pages later. Yeah. Read the fine print, folks. That's assuming there even is fine print.
Yeah. In his defense, there was no fine print.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to go on a quick rant here, fellas, which may not be so quick, but a lot of comics creators, and I love them, and I think they're well intended, but disgust me because they're like, well, those creators knew what they were getting into. BS. A lot of the time, there wasn't even anything. Like, it wasn't even until the '60s, where I'm kind of fudging up timeline a little bit, but it wasn't until later that it was on the back of the checks. You know, a lot of this stuff wasn't as. I mean, a lot of publishing is not even in and out of comics, but like. Pulps, prose, whatever, especially in the 30s, was so Wild West that, you know, no one really knew what was going on. You know, Siegel and Schuster with Superman thought they would just be doing it forever, you know, kind of like a comic strip model. It's rough, man, and it drives me bananas. It drives me bananas to know that I have a better deal on, like, Shudder or Ringside than Carl Burroughs had on Human Torch, or, like, even Alan Moore and Tim Gibbons had on Watchmen.
Yeah.
It drives me bananas. And it drives me bananas, especially how flippant a lot of creators get about this stuff. Because, I don't know, if it wasn't for, like, these old men being exploited, you wouldn't have the careers you have.
Oh, absolutely.
Anyway,
yeah.
That's a truncated version of me mad about creators, right?
It's like any labor movement, right? It's like you need generations of folks just to get ground under the wheels before, there's enough grist to, you know, allow you to actually build some protections in there.
Well, I mean, there's also a thing about it too, where it seems to be a strange dismissiveness in the current generation of creators. And a lot of these guys, like Alan Moore, is a cranky old man. Yeah, dude, he's still the number one selling creator of all time, and he was treated like crap over and over and over again. You'd be pretty cranky too.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And you know, he reinvented your favorite medium. yeah. Like it was no big deal. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
I was trying to tell somebody, I was trying to draw a comparison between the Beatles and Alan Moore to a friend who didn't know a lot, but they were asking me, which is everybody regrets at parties, you know, once they start going into asking about comics. They were like, but doesn't he have all the movies made and this TV show? And I was like, he doesn't really associate with those, partly because of getting burned on it and partly because of the way the rights break down. And creator rights outside of maybe the film industry, just because it's been going on long enough, even then, they're still, you know, to Brian's point about labor movements, we are just scratching the surface of protections for people who create things. It's just, there are lots of people, because we all love creating things, we're willing to do it and sacrifice and get burned. But, you know, there's only so long you can do it and so long and so much you can make without being compensated for it.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, and I think things have improved to a degree, but even still, I mean, you've got situations where I'm going to try to keep this as general as possible, because I don't think the person who shared the story wants to, you know, be on the record about it. But I know a creator who, when they were writing comics for one of the major publishers, they basically kind of reinvented one of their characters. And it was a very popular reinvention, and it wound up appearing in the film adaptation of the comic book. And typically what happens is when one of your characters is used in, you know, the cinematic portrayal, you get a royalty on that. You don't own the character, but at least you get, you know, you get a nice check out of it. And when they went back to the publisher and said, that's great that character X, you know, was on the screen this summer. So what's the arrangement there? And they were told, well, you didn't create the original version of the character. You know, it's just like, yeah, they still figure out ways to cheat you. Yeah. That was a heck of a tangent we just went on. But yeah, you know, I do have to say, though, that like stacking this issue up to the other three Fantastic Four annuals that we've seen so far, is like this felt like a good single issue of a Fantastic Four comic. It didn't quite have the punch of like, this is the thing we've been, you know, building to all year. But, you know, at the same time, I mean, you can't have Reed and Sue get married every year. And who knows, maybe, you know, 3 months before this was to be published, Stan got a frantic call from Martin Goodman saying, you got to put the original torch in something.
Right.
Yeah.
And Jack's busy drawing like his heart out in Thor.
Well, so there we go. That's the original Human Torch. Let's go ahead and take a break. And then when we come back, we're going to check out what Spider-Man was up to this month. So don't go away. We'll be right back here on Marvel by the Month. Okay, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Guys, it's time to talk about Amazing Spider-Man number 42. The Birth of a Superhero, written by Stan Lee, art by John Romita. So the cover and the title and most of the issue are devoted to J. Jonah Jameson's son, John, who spontaneously gets superpowers and beats up Spidey. But the real significance of this issue, I think, comes on the very last page when we get our first glimpse of Mary Jane Watson. So let's take care of the first bit first. The issue opens with a crowd of bystanders witnessing Spider-Man swinging away with a money bag from a bank. It's not a dream. It's not a hoax. It's not an imaginary story. It's the real Spidey. if there's any doubt, he actually talks to himself a little bit later. So you know it's Spider-Man because he's constantly talking to himself. And he throws it from the Queensboro Bridge into the East River. Why? We don't know. But Jonah gets the news just as the space spores that his astronaut son John was exposed to transformed him into a hulking brute. John gets a fancy Tony Stark designed suit. And then his dad says, why don't you go after Spider-Man and be a real hero? So, of course, you know, John's a good son. And that's exactly what he does. They brawl for a while. Spidey escapes. And we learn that the reason Spidey ran off with the money bag was because it had a bomb in it. And then meanwhile, John gets more angry, more violent. He's losing control. Spidey tricks him into zapping himself with a generator. That kills the spores and returns him to normal because he's a science guy.
Yeah.
You know, I just realized Spider-Man tells the bank that there was a bomb in there.
No.
It just occurred to me right now in this moment.
A guy who communicates nonstop verbally doesn't say, you know, there's a bomb in here.
Yeah.
Just that would be enough. But I don't know. I thought that story, just the way it started, I was definitely super interested in why the hell Spidey ran off with a bag from the bank.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, so, cover to cover, this one was great. I really love this issue. Actually, I think it was interesting. I think I mentioned this a little bit before, but it's interesting to read these comics 5 years into this version of Marvel.
Yeah.
Because it really felt like part of this larger Marvel universe in a way you can tell they're tinkering with earlier on, but this has almost felt so natural. Like the Stark reference, they don't show Tony Stark. They're just like, oh yeah, we should contact Stark Enterprises for this armor or whatever. And then they get it to us. Or like there's a Foggy Nelson cameo that felt really natural, you know?
Yeah.
It really felt like, again, in a way, like I feel like with the earlier Marvel books, it's like, whoa, Thor's flying in the background. That's cool. But with this, it's like, oh, it's just part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I just felt this issue was amazing. For it was sort of J. Jonah Jameson's like great power, great responsibility moment, you know, and made him question the nature of his own reality and like the cost of his lies. Now, of course, like in the end, it sort of reverts back to normal. But I thought over the course of it, like there's still like he knows that there is a cost to his sins and the things that like the slandering someone else and it almost destroys his son. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really cool and really powerful.
One of the things that jumped out to me talking of that, Joe, is that I really appreciated the line that Stan was walking, showing Jonah as a father, where he shows that he legitimately loves and cares for his son, and he's supportive of his son, and he thinks his son can be anything he wants to be. If anyone could be a hero, his son can be a hero. But at the same time, he applies the same logic and still hates on Spider-Man, you know? So it's like he's still kind of a piece of crap, but he's not a totally bad guy. It's just, he's got this thesis that he's working on, which is that superheroes are not to be trusted, Spider-Man especially, but my son is a superhero and I love and trust him. So he's the exception. So it's like, you know, it shows that there's good in Jonah and that he can be reasonable.
Although he's kind of like a, you know, dance mom. He's you know, he wants his son to do more because he thrives on the attention his son gets too. So it's like this mm-hmm. weird beauty pageant kind of thing.
Well,
yeah.
To your point about the fatherhood stuff, when he finds out that Spider-Man robbed a bank, or at least it appeared so, what his reaction is like, oh no, so this actually proves my point. Because people like Spider-Man are the problem, but real heroes like my son, you know, that's a real superhero. And then, of course, when anything falls apart, again, it makes him start questioning the nature of his own false reality. But there was some really cool technical stuff in this issue, like Artie Simek, my favorite letters of all time. He did a really cool thing on page 11, panel 5, where the Throck sound effect guided the motion of Spider-Man throwing these bricks, which I thought was really cool. And then on page 16, panel 5 again, he does a really cool thing with Spider-Man's balloon. As Spider-Man is flipping down, the balloon has also flipped down. It's like, so the balloon text is upside down. But I thought that was a really cool way to convey motion through sound effects. slight sidebar, but about a year ago, a friend of our family had a comic book collection of one of the relatives who passed away, and they wanted to help price in it, so I was helping them price in it. And the, one of the cool things about that is I got to go through this comic book collection of like 60s and 70s stuff, and one of them was a copy of this.
Oh man!
And it was cool to reread it, but I was blown away that the panel introducing Mary Jane was just like panel six of whatever.
Yeah.
It wasn't a splash, because in my brain I always had that as a splash page.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting, you know, in terms of the power of like that iconic graphic thing.
Yeah.
You know, because I had read this issue before in reprints, mm-hmm. you know, like the those giant Marvel hardcovers or Marvel Masterworks or whatever. But I don't know. I think that speaks, because like I will say I am more of a Ditko guy when it comes to Spider-Man. I like lanky, like teenager looking Spider-Man who's like mm-hmm. kind of awkward. Where it has his, you know, John Romita Sr., while he's obviously brilliant, his Spider-Man's too much of like a muscle-bound hero than I like. But you can't deny, man, when it comes to the human stuff, especially like the women in these comics,
yeah,
like he conveys it better, I think, than anyone else at the time. You know, and I think you needed him to reveal Mary Jane Watson
yes.
in a way that, as much as I hold up Ditko above anybody when it comes to Spider-Man. Yeah, I don't even know if he could portray it as well as John Romita Sr. did.
Her facial expressions, the way she looks, there is no mistaking her for someone else in the comic. Mm-hmm. Like, she is a very unique individual.
Let's just cover, like, the introduction of Mary Jane, because it's just like, I don't know, it's a great bit of, you know, classic Stan Lee misdirection. After helping John Jameson get restored to normal, Peter heads home, gets a good night's sleep. It's almost too good a night of sleep because he almost oversleeps dinner, which he and Aunt May are going to have at Anna Watson's house. And Peter's finally going to have to meet her niece, Mary Jane. We've been hearing about Mary Jane since Amazing Spider-Man number 15. So this is like almost a 30 issue wait for the payoff. And Peter is dreading it, which has kind of been like, this has been building up and building up, where he's absolutely convinced that this is just, she's going to have a nice personality, and, you know, and that's pretty much it. But in the very last panel, she's at the door opens, and we see her in the doorway, saying the famous line, "Face it, Tiger, you just hit the jackpot." And she's beautiful. Like, Romita, you're absolutely right, Joe. Like, Romita does an amazing job, just bringing her to life. And yeah, she has a totally distinct look, unlike any other character. Like, she's clearly going to be a huge important deal in the book going forward. And it's funny, like, I think my first introduction to Mary Jane was probably like around the McFarlane years, in the mid late 80s, you know, where like she had like the big curly hair and, you know, and all that. And she was a fashion model. And just, you know, really like late 80s Marvel,
like
TNA
Nagel kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, you know, 15, 14 year old me thought that was like, this is all right. But it's like, I love just this really simple, natural presentation of her. And like, there's no trick here. You know, it's like, she's a beautiful woman. And the look on Peter's face, it's like his jaw is about to hit the floor. He's just like framed at the edge of the panel in profile, and his eyes are bugging out of his head. It's brilliant. Like, yeah, it's fantastic.
Aside from Mary Jane, the only thing that I was like, I don't know why I had this confused, because I've read some of these before, but John Jameson getting superpowers, I was like, crap, Man-Wolf is seriously going to happen right now? and I thought I just kept waiting for the story to like turn that way, and it didn't. And I was like, ah. And, you know, that's something we'll get to in, I don't know, if year two, three of this podcast.
I think it's when the comics code lightens up a little bit, because they can't do werewolves mm-hmm. right now.
Yeah.
Great point. Yeah. Yeah. Sometime in the 70s.
Yeah.
But John has some brushes with superpowers or super curses later in his life too. So I don't know why I was like, cause you know, I just associate him with that character cause I love that character, but it's, I just thought maybe this is like the inkling of it, or they're going to start teasing this thing, or, you know, my brain made a whole alternate story that was the space spores starting to cause this and some reason why he goes back to the moon. And I don't know. And so that didn't happen. But
that's the ultimate universe version of John Jameson.
And also that Tony Stark suit was to keep him more powered down. It reminded me of a Kurt Vonnegut short story, the Harrison Bergeron, I think is the name of it, where there's just like super smart people who have to have things that like bells or alarm clocks that go off every 5 minutes on their head so that they can't think too deeply, to make them more normal. And I felt like it was interesting to see a Tony Stark suit that was mostly to depower someone, also so they didn't die. But, you know, that was an interesting thing that I think could have been explored more, where there's this, it's taking his power down a peg, like literally weighing him down, because to him Earth gravity is like moon gravity now, but also trying to keep him from having his heart burst or something, you know. But
right,
still it was just a new spin that we haven't seen a lot of in Marvel comics so far. So I was sad to see that it was just one story arc for this.
But it kind of ties into the Iron Man armor, in that that was preventing Tony's heart from, you know, being destroyed by the shrapnel.
Yeah. There are parallels. I don't know. There's something there that seemed like it could be so much more interesting, but it was just, you know, it was just an ancillary part of the story. So, yeah.
But yeah, great done in one, man. I really thought this was a killer issue.
Yeah, and it's got some little threads that lead into that pick up from previous issues and lead into the next ones. Like the Rhino is still kind of lurking in the background. He was introduced in the last issue. It looked like he was one and done, but now it looks like I think it's great. Like Spider-Man, he defeated the Rhino. He handed him over to the cops, and they're like, oh no, what do we do?
We can't get the suit off him. We don't know if it's his skin.
like, and all they can do is like keep gassing him to knock him out, but like they're warning him, is like, eventually this isn't gonna work anymore. We don't have a plan B. So
it's like the beginning of when they have to start thinking of these like vault situations and you know, superhuman incarceration. It hasn't really been something they talk about. They've tried to put a few people away who just get out, like even the Wizard, you know, can just get out of jail.
Yeah.
The wingless Wizard, if you will. But
No one will. I think it's also kind of amazing, like how quickly John Romita is settling in as the Spider-Man artist. Like, you know, I also am a huge Ditko fan. I think that's still my preferred version of the book, but you know, it's like he's only done four issues so far, and every single one of them has had like some major event or major reveal. It's also obvious. I think Ditko's departure lit a fire under Stan also. He's like, okay, we're going to pull out all the stops. We're going to reveal who who the Green Goblin is. We're going to reveal Mary Jane. We're going to introduce, you know, new villains, and, you know, really, you know, just start going all out to build the book up. And make the readers not miss Ditko so much.
Yeah. And it's so weird just see John Romita Sr. come in like this, because, you know, we haven't seen anything really from him, prior to this. And then he just comes in like fully owning this thing and taking it over, where it feels different, but it doesn't feel like, you know, when Kirby leaves a comic earlier on, like when Don Heck takes over Avengers or something, you notice that Kirby's not there. Or when Dick Ayers takes over on Sergeant Fury, you can tell the difference, and it takes a while to adjust. This, you can tell the difference, but you're still like, all right, I'm on board. It feels like he's that level of an artist.
I was expecting my enthusiasm for Spider-Man to dip after Ditko left, but I'm still on board. Like it's a
very different book, but it's a cool book. You know, I mean, it's Peter Parker, the college years, you know.
And Stan's not letting things hang like that. He's like, you know what, Betty's out, Gwen's possibly in, Mary Jane's in, we're just gonna get these things moving. We're not going to tease them out for another 3 years or whatever.
Yeah. yeah. Although he is definitely setting up the sort of Betty and Veronica dynamic with Gwen and Mary Jane. Cause before she shows up, Peter's daydreaming about Gwen. And so it's like, okay, we know where this is going. Yep. So
romance time.
All right. Well, that's what Spidey was up to. We got one issue left to cover, which is the main reason we wanted to bring Joe on. So let's go ahead and take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk all about Sergeant Fury and his Inglorious Bastards here on Marvel by the Month.
All right. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Let's get into Sergeant Fury number 35, and really, you know, a few issues of Sergeant Fury, but ending in number 35. This is written by Roy Thomas, art by Dick Ayers with John Tartaglione. This is called Berlin Breakout. We wanted to cover this one with Joe because he's a big Tarantino fan, and we've learned even more a big, what did you call that? The
combat, macaroni combat.
Macaroni combat.
That's macaroni combat. Yeah.
And there's a lot of Inglorious Bastards in this issue. Also, he's generally a big Sergeant Fury fan.
Yeah. No, I love war comics big time, and I love, and again, you know, I did but you know, Nick Roy Thomas a little bit for the Captain America stuff. So I got to sing his praises when he writes Fury. It's usually super awesome.
Yes.
But yeah, so the Tarantino thing has been huge for me since I was in high school. In fact, he had a big effect on my comics career in that when I was in high school, I always thought like, oh, well, I wanted to write comics, but you can never like do it. And I remember distinctly, I was working at a video store, and this is actually before I was really into his stuff. I didn't get into a video store because he was working at a video store. But when I was working at Blockbuster Video in La Cunada, California, because I worked at two, one in La Cunada, one in La Crescenta. When I was, I rented for free, Pulp Fiction, and I love the movie, but what I really dug was there's an interview with him on Charlie Rose that they put on the DVD, and on the interview, he's probably like 28, which is like right around, like right after, so it's right after Reservoir Dogs, probably 29, and, young guy, and he's wearing an Astro Boy tie. And I was like, oh, sick, dude's wearing an Astro Boy tie. So before he even says a word, I'm like, oh, I'm really into this guy. And when he was talking about loving movies, I was like, oh, dang, this guy loves movies the way I love comics. Mm-hmm. And I remember distinctly thinking, like, I want to not necessarily be the Tarantino of comics or anything like that, but I want to do with comics what he does with movies, in that, not like to make it crime stuff that is stylized, none of that. But he makes movies to be movies because he loves movies. He's not making movies to necessarily, and look, maybe if Reservoir Dogs didn't hit as well, he would have had a different career where he did this kind of thing. But, you know, even like when he was adapting something like Jackie Brown, right, which is the adaptation of Rum Punch, like even that he made into his own, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, don't get me wrong, like, I've gotten the opportunity to write stuff like Superman, and that was awesome, and Hulk and everything. But I got into comics. I love making stuff, and I love making stuff to be comics, you know, like, you know, look, yeah, some Hollywood stuff was sniffed around my comics. Right. And it's cool, but I got into it cause I wanted to make comics to be comics. I think the art form of comics is so cool. And Tarantino just ever since then has been like, I always thought like I wanted to approach my comics as like the Venn diagram between him and Jack Kirby. Cause not super long, only a few years before that, I discovered Jack Kirby because the Image Comics guys were always talking about him, and I was super into Image Comics. And, for my birthday, my dad had given me a gift certificate to Heidi Ho Comics in Santa Monica, which still exists, a different location, but it was like the store where I discovered comics. And I remember I went in with the gift certificate and I was like, I want a Jack Kirby comic, an original. What do you got for me? And the only thing they give me, which I still have on my spinner rack actually, is Jimmy Olsen number 133, the first like ever Fourth World comic essentially.
Yeah.
And I thought it was so sick because it was like Jimmy Olsen was hanging out with the Grateful Dead kind of like hippies, you know, in the underground, and like he wasn't Superman's friend anymore, and he was like rebelling. And so it was like right at the beginning of my own adolescence. So anyway, So that was already in the back of my head. And Tarantino had that sort of rebellious aspect with his own stuff. And I was like, oh, this is like the combination of these guys in my brain is how I wanted to approach things going into it. And so, yeah, I don't know. And I've always just, his movies have always meant a lot to me. And like, I have a great memory of seeing Inglourious Basterds at the Castro Theater in San Francisco, which is like, you know, a, not Gilded Age, but it is like golden age movie palace type of place. And just, you know, the very last line, Aldo Rain saying, this may be my masterpiece. And I'm just like, and I just, the whole theater just like erupted. And I was like, ah, this was amazing. And I think it's only topped possibly by Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I love for other reasons. But anyway,
yeah.
Point is, yeah, I love Inglourious Basterds. I love Tarantino. Anytime he does, like, he's been doing a lot of interviews on the Pure Cinema podcast, which is like sponsored by his New Beverly Theater. And anytime I'm in LA, I remember actually one of the last times I was in LA for a business thing, I had exactly 3 hours, no, 4 hours to like get to the New Beverly, see a double feature, and then get back to my hotel. And I took an Uber through LA traffic to make this happen. I barely made it in, but I don't know. I love how much that guy loves movies, you know?
Yeah.
And I to this day, like, that's my favorite thing about meeting people. It doesn't have to be stuff I'm into, but I love talking with or being talked to by people who are just really into something. I don't care if it's like Formula One racing or knitting or whatever. And so anytime Tarantino has an interview, I just feel so pumped to just love stuff and make stuff. And it's also affected my approach to just things in general. Like, I feel in this day and age, it's so popular to just consistently dunk on things and just like talk about what sucks. And I just find I think that's so boring. Like, I will dunk on dunking, that's for sure. it's so cynical, but I love how, like, when people like him talk about those things that they're into. So anyway, long story short is that he's had a huge influence on me. And not even like stylistically with my work, but just like approaching my enthusiasm for comics and, you know, making comics. So
yeah,
Inglourious Basterds is one of my all time favorite movies. It is, and it's ridiculous. You guys did not overhype how much, like, I'm convinced he probably read this comic at some point, like as a kid, and it was like in the background of his brain.
Yeah,
it's like how when you write stuff, you don't necessarily know where your influences are. It's obvious he's a big Sergeant Fury fan. In fact, Sergeant Fury, the comics appear in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But there's so many little things in this issue. Like, just get into it. There's a character who essentially is Hugo Stiglitz.
Yes. Yep.
You know, there's a character who's like a Nazi who's now hanging out with this iteration of the Howling Commandos. I guess, am I just talking to the plot now? I don't know.
That's all right. But okay, I guess I want to ask you, so you've read a lot more of war comics in general than probably either of us have. Where do you rank this one or this, you know, like three story arc, the three issue arc?
I mean, that's tough. Cause I mean, you know, are you comparing it to the Nom? Are you comparing it to Blazing Combat? You know, it's like, like it's a different kind of war comic than like, say, Kurtzman's EC stuff that is just like gut wrenching you, you know?
Yeah.
I will say in terms of Fury comics, I thought this was awesome. Mm-hmm. Like I it way up there in terms of Fury comics. I love a great war comic. I it's nothing I've ever wanted to write though. I feel weird about writing. I feel anyone who's not a veteran writing war comics is pretty weird.
Yeah.
And I'm really uncomfortable with it, actually. Like when I read people who are 20 years old write about Vietnam, I was like, my stepdad fought in Vietnam, dude. Like, they want to chill out there. Like, I would never write a Vietnam comic. And of course, like 5 years from now, someone will quote this and I have written a Vietnam comic. But like, I don't know. I have a lot of military family, and just like, I think that's one of the reasons why I like these comics so much, especially when they're written by people who have served, you know?
Yeah.
But like the Doug Murray, and of course I want to credit Michael Golden and the Nom, is just like, it's amazing Marvel was printing a comic like that in 85, 86.
Yeah.
You know? And it's a gut wrencher. So whereas the Fury stuff is just like fun war stuff. But again, like we've talked about this before, 60s Marvel is pretty interesting in how they compare. Like Captain America, I think, is the best example. Because when Captain America is in the 40s and even the 50s, it's very much rah-rah America. But when he appears in Avengers 4, he's a dude. They're dealing with PTSD.
Yeah.
They're not outright lame, but he has PTSD throughout his whole existence from there on out, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think they even explicitly have him talk about combat fatigue, which is what they used to call PTSD. Like, yeah. You know.
Yeah, I've seen other people talk about this. Writer Paul Lohr, who's doing G.I. Joe right now,
mm-hmm.
I've read G.I. Joe since I was a kid, but he sent me his PDF of, I want to say, G.I. Joe number 6 or 7. And, you know, as far as I know, Paul didn't serve, but he did consult with a lot of people who did serve. And it's an amazing issue about dealing with PTSD in a way that, like, I don't know. I think you'd have to do what Paul did and go all in and do your research and just get it down, or be someone who served to properly do a work on. But anyway,
yeah.
That's not answering your question. That's a huge a million tangents. I thought this was an amazing Fury issue. I really loved it. But yeah, the bastards. Oh, sorry. Did you say you had a second question?
I don't even know now, but it really was where it ranks. But I think that you gave us a broader reason why that's complicated, but also that it's great, you know, that this is, whether or not it's conscious, it feels like it inspired a lot of plot elements in Inglorious Bastards.
I mean, again, I think Tarantino's too imaginative to be like, oh yes, there's one random issue of Sergeant right. Fury. That is what I'll compare. But like when I first saw Bastards, I was like, this is the best Fury comp or movie that's ever going to exist.
Yes, exactly. You know?
Aldo Raine, Brad Pitt is Aldo Raine. I was like, oh, he's totally Fury, you know? Yeah, I don't know. In fact, then wasn't Brad Pitt in a movie called Fury? Oh, like a World War II movie?
The tank movie?
I never saw that one. Yeah. I was like, oh, that is too funny.
Getting back into these Sergeant Fury issues, and especially when Kirby was drawing to some of the scenes in Europe, it was...
Oh, dude.
It was like heart-wrenching. And, and these get a little more, you know, I don't know. The stories just get a little more far-fetched, but it's still...
Mm-hmm.
A little might be an understatement, but it's so good. And that's also what makes it's just like touching on all these historical figures, places, moments. Sergeant Fury is always somehow involved. And as we get going in the 60s version, and it's so great.
I think it's the challenge of how do you do a war comic under the most restrictive version of the comics code, you know, like
nobody can be seen dying. Point. Yeah.
I'm a huge EC Comics fan, and I love Frontline Combat. I love, you know, all the Kurtzman war stories. But you literally just could not tell those stories in 1966.
Oh, no way.
And I think, I think when Sergeant Fury first started up and Stan was writing it and Jack was drawing it, I think they were trying to do a more verite version of war comics, you know, I mean, basically like a Kurtzman light, you know, whatever, as far as they could go with it. You know, to the point where, like, I think in the first couple issues, like one of the Howlers dies, you know, and, you know, so just showing the costs of war. But yeah, I mean, I think especially as those two left the book and then, you know, Dick Ayers and then Roy Thomas come on, you're starting to get a more superhero-y version of war comics. This one is just like a crazy action romp, and it has a little bit of everything. It hits all those buttons that a good Nick Fury story should have. It's got, you know, his feud with Bull McGivney, the leader of the rival outfit, the Marauders. It's got, you know, ex-Nazi helping Fury out. It's got an aerial dogfight. It's got infiltrating. It's got literally Adolf Hitler as the final boss. It's so over the top. It's great.
But yeah, with the Bastards parallels, like, it starts off right away because, like, the usual crew's, well, in terms of Bastards, dead, but in this, like, they're imprisoned. And so it's like this ragtag group with Aldo Raine, you know, running in. There's little tiny weird things, like there's a Cats and Jammer Kids reference, which there's a Cats and Jammer Kids reference. Yeah, and page 17. And then on page 19 of this, you have Hitler slamming the desk saying 9999, like there isn't bastards. And then there's, of course, a big scene in the movie theater, you know, in a giant ambush. And I mean, they don't outright kill anyone, although I kind of lost track, to be honest. But it's pretty brutal. I mean, for a comic in 66, like there's not like massive amounts of blood, but people are dying left and right, especially the Nazis, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a point where Hitler is making his escape from the theater where he's got the Howlers held hostage. Oh, and the reason they're at the theater is because Hitler personally wants to execute them, which
wants it filmed for a movie.
Yes.
Yeah. And Goebbels is there to like film it and set up how Fury gets in is with the camera crew. There's all this motion picture element in this as well. You know?
Yeah. Like they disguise as cameramen. Yeah. Just like bastards.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And so as Hitler is escaping, like his guards are rushing in to take on the Howlers, and he's like, "Yes, yes, for the glory of Germany." And he's thinking to himself, "It's like, you fools, like just throw your bodies at the barricade. All that matters is that I escape." I mean, he's like a Dr. Doom, like, or not even a Dr. Doom. Because he's a jerk.
He's a Dr. Dimwit. Like, I was kind of harping on like realism war comics, but Hitler's such a POS that I'm fine with him being treated like a cartoon character because he's an idiot.
We can dunk on Hitler.
Yeah. I loved how like there's one scene which I can't imagine this was unintentional, but page 12 his eyes are cross-eyed.
Yes.
Which I really liked. And then on page 15 honestly it's not a bad tactic. He's like, "Oh yeah, I'm actually a Hitler double." Like the last one you killed. Yeah. Fury's like, "You dumbass, I know it's you, you know?"
Yeah.
But yeah, and Hugo Stiglitz, who's not called Hugo Stiglitz, is Eric.
Eric Koenig, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Oh man, I love that character. I thought that was so cool.
Yep. And he winds up becoming one of the new Howling Commandos because on the way, as the Howlers are making their escape from the theater where, you know, Hitler's had them brought, Dino winds up getting shot up. He survives, but the war is over for him, basically.
Yeah, he's running a distraction and gets real shot up.
Yeah.
Again.
You know, the Howlers have a, you know, a one out, one in policy. So, you know, despite the fact that they're a totally, you know, informal ragtag group of commandos, like they have some pretty strict rules for, you know, how many we have to have. So, you know, when Junior Juniper got killed, that's when we got the British guy who's
Percy.
I'm blanking.
Yeah.
Percy. Yeah. We got Percy and his umbrella. And then, you know, with Dino leaving, now he gets, Eric, the ex-Nazi.
I do like how they keep making the commando team more, you know, multinational, that it's like the United Nations that punches you in the face. You know, it just represents the Allies better as it goes. So I don't know why it's even more weirdly far-fetched for political reasons and organization, but there were, you know, different members of the RAF, you know, training or serving. I also like that this three-story arc shows a little of Dum Dum's sort of origin as a Howler. Like it shows him in the circus. It shows, and Sergeant Fury, like it shows Fury as just like a paratrooper trainer for the RAF. So he was a civilian, you know?
Yeah. He starts out as like a punk kid who's like, you know, just working as part of a barnstorming team and then winds up, you know, which is very true to how Kirby always envisioned him, because Fury is supposed to be like very similar in origin to Kirby, you know, growing up on the streets, you know, running with a bad crowd and, you know, living by his fists and then, you know, gradually get some of the rough edges sanded off, but not very many.
Just enough to be, you know, keep the edges that help in war.
which
works. Yeah. So that makes him, this made me love Fury as a character more. These three issues leading up to this, it made him so much more filled out than sort of that. He was flat, but lovable. You know, he's just sort of this brash sergeant who loves his guys, but is going to make them run an extra 15 miles, you know, now he's like more fully formed for me. So there's more at stake.
I think this is the first time we've actually had a Nick Fury comic on as like the headlining spot on the podcast. And I'm glad we could do it with you, Joe, since you're a fan.
My pleasure.
This also, unfortunately, like because of the way Marvel Unlimited works, we've only got a few more issues of Nick Fury coming up after, I think, starting with Sergeant Fury number 44. They're not on Marvel Unlimited right now. So unless that changes, it's something we're just going to, you know, not really be able to focus on. So, which is unfortunate.
That's a bummer. There's some great stuff because then, like, John Severin comes on board. And
I know. Yeah. I love John Severin.
Severin's stuff in S.H.I.E.L.D. when he first showed up there was mind-blowing, too.
You know what, though? Sergeant Fury should actually get reasonably
like
priced,
some collections.
Especially if you don't care about condition. Yeah. Like, yeah. Whenever I buy them, it's like $5-$10, which is but it's not bad.
Yeah. We'll have Uncle Joe's Sergeant Fury story time out. You can just. He could just read them out loud to us.
For sure.
Well, that wraps up our discussion of the issues. So now we've just got the panels of the month to talk about. So my panel of the month comes from an issue we didn't really go in depth on, and we just talked about it a little bit right up front. But it's Tales of Suspense number 83. This is in the Iron Man story. Payoff issue for the fight against the Titanium Man, page 7, panel 1. And all it is it's a half-page panel of LBJ and Robert McNamara in profile watching TV coverage of Iron Man fighting the Titanium Man. So Gene Colan came on as the regular artist for Iron Man several issues ago. And we haven't talked a lot about Iron Man lately, but I think the stories are still a little But the artwork is just gorgeous. Like, Colan is really, he's coming into his own as a superhero artist. I mean, he had his bona fides doing non-superhero stuff. You know, he had a long career behind him. But I feel like now he's really getting his arms around the superhero stuff. And his Iron Man stuff has gotten very, very good. So that's the panel that jumped out at me.
Yeah, I've got a bunch, and they're all from the Thor issue. 132. So I feel like I don't want to walk on Joe's toes if he's got one in mind too. We called out a few of them. So I'm going to name one as my, you know, like silver medalist, and then go to the gold. But Thor 132, page 10, panel 1, we see Ego. This is my silver medalist. Sort of. It's this very EC Comics looking panel. It's full page width. Ego is sort of spewing out into these sort of, it reminds me of like Dead Alive, like this, like pussy looking growths, like shooting out around, the recorder and Thor, and his face is there. And it's all just sort of in this purple wash, and it's kind of gross and super interesting at the same time. And then, but the real one is the stack. We talked about it, like putting over of Ego with the antibodies. It is a full splash page of Thor and the recorder engulfed in a tower of these like fighting antibody superhuman guys. And it's just a beautiful page. Like you could have nothing on this and just Kirby drawing just, I don't know, there's easily 40 of these antibody people, maybe even more. They're just like trying to do a jelly bean estimate here, piled up in this tower of people, of you know, like humanoid like things attacking Thor, who's at the very top in the upper right corner, and it's just coming up from the bottom left. And it's there are like 20 panels in this thing that really took my breath away, but yeah. That's just a indicative of what this issue is like.
Yeah. And I think what's most impressive about that splash is in the caption box in the corner, you find out that since cameras are expressly forbidden anywhere in Ego's Bioverse, King Kirby was forced to draw this inimitable illustration entirely from memory, which is pretty cool when you think about it. He didn't even use photo reference for this.
I love that. Oh, awesome.
I like that Stan took up that part of the panel. He's like, there's a big empty spot there. I'm going to just put this
in. Gotta put something.
Yeah. There's not enough words on this whole page. Yeah.
This needs some purple prose.
I'm really glad you covered Thor, because I did not actually for my, okay. my panel. And I thought it was filled with good. My, actually, my favorite is totally opposite direction, which was The Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 3, final page, second to last panel. And it's like Peter like hitting down on a stack of papers. And it's that moment where he's struggling with his principles despite, you know, like where he sticks by his principles despite how obviously to his advantage it would work out otherwise. And it shows that combination of strength and also just like feeling completely beat up and just destroyed. But I thought it was such a cool, I mean, it speaks to Romita's strength. It was such a cool panel and it conveyed so much. I mean, granted, of course, there is the text as well, but it conveyed so much about what I love about Peter Parker specifically in one small character moment. Like, yeah, it says, like, why does nothing seem to work out right for me? Even when I win, I lose. So anyway,
and having
I don't know, again, it's a piece of strength.
The back, he's like
having the webs in the background. Yeah.
It's like, no, he's, for sure. He's in his, you know, normal guys leaning over this desk, but it's the webs with the red wash in the background, just mm-hmm. to remind you of the, that sort of, again, it's like Ditko did this too. The ghost of Spider-Man hanging over everything he does and every decision he makes.
Good month of issues.
Yeah. No, great stack, man. Yeah.
And Joe, thanks again for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be on. Yeah. I love it.
Similarly to what you've talked about with Tarantino, your enthusiasm and passion, it makes me feel like going out and doing something every time we talk, you know? So,
yeah. Oh, that seems awesome. That means a lot. I mean, yeah, it brings it full circle. That's great to hear.
Joe, I don't know if you have anything to plug, but I'm going to plug your Instagram account because you've been doing. Yeah, you've been doing a series of spinner rack mini essays. Mm-hmm. You have this. Folks can go to our social media and see the screenshot that we're going to put up. But you've got a spinner rack in the background with a phenomenal selection, beautifully curated selection of issues, and some really just wonderful prose to accompany it, which should not come as a surprise.
Thank you.
I guess
if anything to plug, it'd be that, is I'm starting a series called Spinner Rack Diaries that's going to be through my Instagram, at least initially. But my idea and inspiration for it was like I was saying earlier, there's so much naysaying and so much doomsaying about comics these days. And the way I have my spinner rack structured is that each side is a different decade, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I don't have that there for nostalgia. I have that there to examine the progress and be inspired by the progress that we had in the past that led to me wanting to make comics, because I've essentially, like, that's after the 90s, like, that's when I started to make comics in, like, 2003. And so I think about so much about where we've gone to think about where we could go, you know, and, like, that while there's so much turmoil is in the world, much less the industry, and so much change, like we've been through worse and we can do like better. And the thing I get excited about is that there's this repeating pattern through comics where, like, every time things get really bad, things get amazing afterwards. And it's tough because not a lot of people make it through that down period. But if you can make it, like, after the DC implosion, I've been thinking about the DC implosion in 1978. Because, I mean, news is out there that there is a bunch of layoffs at DC, and it's really too bad. A lot of great people got let go. But I feel like, you know, if those people get either to the right publishers or, unfortunately, even out of comics, or fortunately for comics, not unfortunately for them, into the right places, you can have – so in 1978, DC imploded. But then after that, in the 80s, like the 80s side of my spinner rack, every single slot is a different publisher because mm-hmm. there was so much creativity. And if we can learn from the mistakes that were made in the 80s in terms of oversaturation and just putting garbage out to put stuff out. And, you know, I don't know. I think it could be a really cool time for comics. So anyway, my spinner rack diaries is sort of like examining, and some of it, it's just gonna be like, this is cool. This is a cool dog, you know, but I think that's enough at times, you know, especially in this day and age where so much of social media is just railing against every single thing, you know? The other thing I'll plug, which came out before this, but relates to Marvel by the Month, is I did a couple of backups for Eric Larson's Savage Dragon. Gosh, is it 250? Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of them is a backup called Yankee Rebel that I was inspired by reading, like, the Tales from Suspense, Captain America stuff through this podcast. And honestly, a lot of, I think about this podcast, something that we've talked about before, and I know you guys talked about Ibrahim Mustafa when he was on here, but is how much, like, the storytelling has changed and the mechanics has changed. And I was trying to think of, like, how could I do this now in a way that's, again, not nostalgic, but also sort of comments on the difference of not even comics, not in comics at all now, but like the time period of then and the time period of now. Mm-hmm. And not even through the storytelling as much as like the mechanics of the comic. So anyway, it sold out at distributor level. I'm sure you still get it through shops, and this was reprinted. But yeah, that story exists because of being on Marvel by the Month. So I want to make sure.
Wow.
Thanks, man. That's very generous of you.
It's just the facts.
This is circular inspiration. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, congrats for getting the story in there. And then also, I mean, congrats to Eric Larson, 250 issues. Like, I remember when Savage Dragon number one came out, talking about like distributor implosions and, you know, and comics industry being shaken up. Like, I remember everyone being so down on the Image guys when they split off from Marvel and they set up their whole thing, and everyone was so ready just to crap all over everything they were doing. And well, look, 250 issues later, I don't think Eric's got anything left to prove. Like,
yeah, Larson's the man. I love that guy. He's a great friend, but he's also like one of my biggest inspirations. I mean, Savage Dragon was like the book for me growing up, you know? I don't know, just that guy, like, speaking of like kind of the, like, he's got strong principles and he's got strong opinions, but he always sticks by it. Like, how can you argue 250 issues, no background artists? I mean, there's a letter and a colorist, and he even colored and lettered some of it, you know? So, it's an honor to be some small part of that issue. Cause that guy rules.
Nice.
Very cool. Very cool.
You should have him on here. He would be amazing.
Hook us up.
Yeah. All right. He's got some free time.
I'm sure Eric Larson has nothing better to do than join us for this. Eric, if you're listening, drop us a line at marvelbythemonth@gmail.com or visit us at marvelbythemonth.com. You can find our Instagram, which is not as good as Joe's, but it's pretty fun, at marvelbythemonth.com. Thank you. I think that's it for this episode. Rob, you got anything you want to mention?
Absolutely. The only thing, I think I mentioned this last time too, we've got more stuff, you know, stuff I designed for the podcast too, but we have like face masks that say Marvel by the Month. I also have some stuff that's like spoofing G.I. Joe, that says not knowing is the other half of the battle on it. That's been going pretty well on face masks, especially lately. But I'll share some of that too. But we're doing our things. We're trying to create other things. We do this because we love it. We love comics and we are inspired by them in everything we do. They inspire music. They inspire, you know, everything I possibly do. They're why I do design. Why I have a job, a day job.
Yeah.
So, just continue to be inspired, everybody. That's all I got to say.
There you go. That's a tip from your Uncle Rob. I think all that remains is just for me to say that my name's Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
And I'm Joe Keating.
And that's Joe Keating. Joe. He stole Ibrahim's gimmick. Some of us will see you next week for next month. Bye-bye.